with the initiative's special projects manager, James Whitehead. During the interview, we spoke about some of the work of the Mitigating Wildfire Initiative and some of the common misconceptions surrounding how wildfires are perceived and dealt with. Please take a listen.
We tend to use the tools of dialogue, facilitation, and engagement to really try and address some of the complexities around wildfire management and mitigation in BC. So my role specifically within the organization is figuring out this messy intersection between wildfire and forest management. So how our forest sector plays into the challenge of wildfires and how they can be part of the solution. But on top of that, we also do work looking at cultural burning, indigenous fire stewardship, rural evacuation reluctance, and a lot of other factors that kind of all link into this really complex question of wildfire in BC.
When was the initiative first formed? When was it decided that something like this was as necessary as it was?
Yeah, so the initiative was formed, I believe, close to 4 years ago now. Kind of the brainchild of Robin Prest, who's one of the directors at the Center for Dialogue, and then Yolanda Clatworthy, who's the director of this program. And then I came in as the second employee about 8 months later, so I've been here just over 3 years now.
From being a part of the Mitigating Wildfires Initiative, what are some of the core solutions that the people involved with the initiative, including yourself, have, I guess, come to when it comes to addressing wildfires as we are now experiencing them pretty much every summer?
Yeah, so this is a really disappointing answer, but fires are really a frustrating thing where there aren't necessarily clean solutions. So fundamentally, throughout most of British Columbia and most of Canada, we do live in fire-prone forests. So these are forests that ecologically are designed to burn on a regular basis. Some are designed to burn at a low intensity every 10 to 15 years, and some are designed to burn in a catastrophic, extreme manner once every 100, 200 years. And so fundamentally, when we consider what we're doing with wildfire, we have to recognize that these are still forests that do need to burn and we expect to burn. With that being said, we've also deprived these forests of fire for 100 plus years. So these forests have 100 years of buildup that naturally would have burnt off on a much more regular basis. And so they're quite departed from what the healthy natural forest might have looked like. And that was through lightning fires. That was often through cultural burning from First Nations people. And what we're seeing now is that coupled with climate change is leading to these really catastrophic fires. And coupled with the expansion of communities out into more rural areas, we're seeing that those more catastrophic fires really interact negatively with communities. So when it comes to solutions, those solutions have to recognize those fundamental factors and not simply be suppression focused, i.e. trying to stop fires quicker and quicker and quicker, because that's essentially the same logic that's got us into this situation. What we do need to really focus on is to think about that ecosystem restoration, how we restore some of those ecosystems to a more healthy state. So up in the northern forests, this probably is less relevant. But in the southern and interior forests that we see throughout much of BC, those forests are meant to be very wide open. I've heard people describe it as you could ride a horse through them. And that's not the forest we see today. So that's generally looks like more thinning, so clearing out some of the smaller trees. So it's not logging where we're taking the big valuable trees that are most marketable. It's taking the smaller, less valuable trees and thinning those ecosystems out a little bit. It's also burning more in those ecosystems. So they are fire-dependent forests. We need to restore those natural fire cycles. And then on top of that, it looks like just living with fire. So an expectation within populations that live through most of interior BC, that fire is a healthy and natural and manageable part of the ecosystem, and that people need to be prepared for that. So the unfortunate reality of living in BC is smoke will be a factor in our life. And to a point, we can try and stop it, but we also really need to focus on how we live with this hazard as people. And so that's really preparing our homes, our communities, our properties.
Mm-hmm. Earlier, you mentioned this idea that the very aggressive wildfires are due to decades of buildup in which there were no fires. Can you explain that a bit more? What that, I guess, is in reference to?
Yeah, so that's not to say that there weren't huge fires in the past. There absolutely were. But what we've seen is throughout much of interior BC, these are forests that were designed to burn every 5 to 50 years, depending on where you are. As we've stopped those fires from happening, More and more trees have built up, so those fires naturally would have killed a lot of the smaller trees and vegetation and brush. And so as we've stopped those fires, we've got really, really good at putting out small fires. Those forests have been allowed to become denser and denser and denser, and in some places they're 10 times as dense as they used to be, meaning that they look very different. And when a fire comes through now, it's going to essentially kill everything. It's so much more fuel in the landscape for those fires to burn. And so when it's thinned out, that's not to say that the fires won't burn, but they'll burn at a much smaller, like much lower intensity, at a smaller scale, and be much more manageable and controllable. So there's photos of Jasper from the 1920s versus when it burnt just last 2 years ago. And the difference in the landscape is absolutely massive. We're used to have these patchworks of forests in different places, these big openings, the forests that you did see have holes in them and thinned areas. And now we just see this carpet of green across the landscape. And so that increase in vegetation is really the challenge right now, as we're dealing with so much fuel in the landscape that never was there before.
And that's, I guess, part of the factors, or that is a factor in there being a such a stark increase in wildfires within recent years throughout BC.
Yeah, absolutely. So one stat that surprises a lot of people is we're not actually seeing more fires in BC than we have before. What we're starting to see is bigger fires and catastrophic fires. And really, this ties into the focus shouldn't be necessarily as much on what starts the fire. The focus is why these fires are spreading. And what we've done is kind of created the perfect conditions for these fires to spread by, I mean, not necessarily adding fuel to the fire in most cases, but we've simply not removed fuel from the fire for a century, and then we warm the climate, and then we put more humans in that situation. It's really the perfect storm. So fundamentally, that just goes back to the recognition that most of BC is in a fire-prone ecosystem. It is an area that needs to burn, and we have to live with that reality.
You had mentioned the initiative also working with Indigenous communities and partners. Can you speak on that? Some of the partners that the initiative has been working with and their contributions to the work?
Yeah, so when it comes to Indigenous communities, there's been a huge resurgence in interest on something known as cultural burning. And so cultural burning can be used for community protection, but cultural burning also really recognizes the importance of fire in restoring cultural values. So sometimes that's medicines and plants that really respond well to burning. Sometimes that's supporting mammals and ungulates. And sometimes those are spiritual or other cultural values that are maybe less apparent to us from the outside. And this restoration of cultural burning has really been kind of one of the biggest, most positive signs we've seen in recent years, where a lot of nations are kind of taking this into their own hands and leading the charge. And so we've seen a lot of great examples of cultural burning happening. And there's organizations like First Nations Emergency Services who provide a lot of the infrastructure and framework. And then on top of that, we have groups like First Nations Forestry Council and a lot of independent nations and bands that have expressed support or interest in doing this. So our role in this has largely been in a support role. So we've, my colleague Yolanda, convened a workshop a while back with a bunch of Indigenous youth and on a canoe trip, so all off on the land, and worked with elders to go and provide some of the lessons that those elders had learned burning their whole lives in some case, to really try and help build that next generation of young fire keepers. We've also helped with supporting Indigenous-only conversations around fire stewardship. So a lot of the time we see cultural burning as an add-on to prescribed burning. So we will talk about prescribed burning, and then First Nations are also doing this work, so it's prescribed and cultural burning. But that doesn't necessarily reflect the additional complexities that nations are facing in doing this work. And so Yolanda has really been there to, in some cases, just provide the space, provide the venue for those conversations that are maybe are happening in a sort of in community to community or nation to nation way. And so they aren't just sort of shoehorned or added as an add-in to a broader conversation about burning.
Yeah, it's I guess incorporating a perspective that maybe hasn't been as incorporated in past mitigation initiatives, especially like in academia and stuff like that. So it was interesting to see that specific perspective championed in the way that it was through this.
Yeah, we're starting to see, and this is I think one of the most promising or interesting signs of progress, is the absolutely rapid expansion of interest in cultural burning and real efforts to address some of the legal and liability barriers around it. There's still a huge amount of work to do, and it's by no means happened at the scale anyone wanted to, but the change in the last even 3 years since I've been involved with this project has been pretty remarkable to see.
This next question I have is a little bit self-serving, but I noticed that there was the toolkit regarding wildfire communication for journalists. Can you tell me a bit about that? What were the gaps, I suppose, in wildfire communication that you felt needed to be addressed?
Yeah, so this workshop came about due to a few reasons. One is we see adversarial situations where journalists and fire agencies very routinely, and it's something that kind of you might not be as familiar from on the outside, where you just sort of see a news report, but there's a lot of complexities as to how to report around wildfire. And there's a couple key points that have come up over and over again. The first is the question of access. In an active emergency zone or disaster area, how much access should journalists get if it takes crews away from their job to make sure journalists are safe or in the right area? How much should we prioritize that? The second is, how do we tell a story around fire? If someone is sleeping in their cars after being evacuated from a wildfire, is that a failure on government? Do we talk about that in the right way? Like often it's presented as this big failure, but these are emergencies. We can foresee them happening, but we don't know where and when and how they're going to happen. And then finally, how can we tell the story of fire in a more positive or more collaborative way? Not simply as fire is this enemy that is coming for your home, your livelihood, your property, but how can we tell the story of fire as a natural part of the ecosystem? How can we tell the story of the cultural values of fire that we see in so many indigenous communities across the province? And so there's this really, I think, complex state of telling the story around fire, and we really wanted to kind of dig into that a little bit. So for me personally, one of the inspirations was seeing a headline around a fire near a community, and the fire went from 4 to 16 hectares overnight, and two homes have been put on evacuation alert, not order, so just highlighting that there may potentially be a risk to the home. And the headline on a major newspaper was, man-made inferno quadruples in size overnight, threatens homes. And nothing is objectively incorrect about that, but it's creating a very misleading kind of panic-driven narrative. And so what we did was we had a workshop in Sun Peaks, and we had, I believe it was about 20 to 25 journalists, and 20 to 25 fire experts, ranging from smoke researchers to operations people within the wildfire service to cultural burning experts to foresters, and basically had this conversation around what is the story we need to tell around wildfire. And so two areas where that really came up were the access question. What does access look like for journalists on a fire? Should any journalist be able to come and get unlimited access? Should there be mandatory training? That sort of thing. And that was a little more unresolved, because that's frankly outside our wheelhouse to really lead that conversation. But then the second was, how do we tell the story of fire, and what does responsible journalism look like? And so can we tell the story of fire throughout the winter and the spring and the fall to highlight what people can be doing to prepare? How can we report day of? And so that's really the piece that came up is just that overall narrative around fire, because some journalists do a great job, but there's a lot of really poor, I think, kind of sensationalist journalism and kind of panic-stricken journalism or panic-inducing journalism around wildfire. And once again, it comes back to that fundamental piece that it is a natural phenomenon that is going to happen in this area, and we need to be able to tell that story in a calm, responsible, measured way.
Yeah, I think what I'm hearing from that is that obviously it's important to address like the suffering that it can cause, but then also to not address it and come at it with this level of alarmism or ascribing the fires to one specific cause in particular and not considering, I guess, a more holistic approach to reporting on it.
Yeah, I think I deal with the fire all the time. It's my day job, quite literally. And the complexities of fire blow me away all the time. The complexities of the trade-offs needed to address it, and the complexities of how you respond to an emergency. And I think that, I mean, complexities are a really difficult thing to communicate publicly. That's the standard challenge in journalism, from my understanding. And fire is such a key element of that. And then I think the other piece is simply recognizing that things aren't going to be perfect. A fire is a natural event that causes huge strain, puts huge stress on responders, and decisions aren't always going to be perfect. And we can't recognize the presence of a big fire in BC as a failure of government or a failure in suppression. It's simply the way it is sometimes. And yeah, I think journalism has got a lot better about fires. When I started this, we never used to hear solutions-based journalism about fires. We never heard anything about cultural burning, and now every year those are part of the conversation. So I think it's teaching, helping a generation of journalists learn how to cover this story, and especially when you bring in the factors of climate change and how we talk about that. But at the same time, it's also helping an agency that has largely operated in remote forested areas all of a sudden deal with this intense media scrutiny and intense media landscape. And so that work, I think, is somewhat unfinished, but I do hope that the journalism report or journalism bootcamp might have helped at least provide a useful guide to those that are having to tell the story.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's very, very important work and being able to effectively communicate something that is affecting everyone, not just in BC, but like throughout Canada, in the United States, in Europe, as well. Those were the main questions I had for this interview, but if there are any other, I guess, upcoming or current projects of the Mitigating Wildfire Initiative that we didn't touch on that you'd want to speak on, what would that be?
Well, thanks for the questioner. We actually tend to wind down our operations a lot in the summer, and the reason is a lot of the people we would work with are really, really busy right now. So, rather than Yeah, I don't really have anything direct to promote at the moment, but I think the biggest thing I would highlight is just the importance of preparation and recognizing that if you live in British Columbia, you live in a fire-prone ecosystem, and just recognizing that this is something that at the very least you need to be aware of, and at the very least you need to understand could happen. And so just when it comes to emergency planning and the documents and knowing what you would do, just spend 10 minutes and have a think about that. That's all I can really ask at the moment.
Once again, that was our conversation with James Whitehead, the Special Projects Manager for the Mitigating Wildfire Initiative at SFU, that is working towards creating new preventative solutions for addressing wildfires throughout BC. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
This is Bird Note. Sometimes birds have common names that aren't very descriptive. Not so for the black and white warbler. Smaller than a sparrow, these stripy black and white songbirds are always on the move. They feast on insects gleaned from leaves or plucked from cracks in tree bark. You'll often find them clinging to tree trunks or the undersides of thick branches, acting more like a nuthatch than a warbler. In the winter months, black and white warblers thrive in a wide variety of habitats, from the southern U.S. to Colombia. But they breed in North America's deciduous forests, where males sing a repetitive, high-pitched, wheezy, wheezy, wheezy song, a little bit like a squeaky shopping cart. Like many songbirds, black and white warblers migrate at night, using the stars to navigate. Unfortunately, nocturnal light pollution can disrupt their sense of direction or cause them to collide with buildings. You can help black and white warblers by turning off outdoor lights and shading your windows at night, especially during migration season. Learn more about Lights Out initiatives for birds when you visit our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel. Bird Note is supported by Chris Kluett of Seattle and by generous listeners around the world.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We are fueled by your support. You make CJSF.
This is Nicole Hines with CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, and I'm here with Scott Gurney, Executive Director of 17 Black Events, and we're going to chat about the festival that he's a founder of, Brewery and the Bees, which is happening in Vancouver on August 30th at Concord Pacific Place, 811 Carroll Street. My first question is, would you mind sharing like a bit of the history about this festival?
Yeah, for sure. So we started the event in Victoria, BC in 2012. And we hosted the first event at the Phillips Brewing Company in mid-September. And off of the strength of that event, we had some friends visit from Vancouver who were in the culinary community, and they said, you know, we'd love to see this in Vancouver. So the following year, we did the event in Vancouver in 2013, and then 2 years later in Calgary. So 2015 was our inaugural event there. And just a few weeks ago, we produced our first annual event in Toronto. So we've managed to expand the event into Eastern Canada and have grown it over the years into a really, you know, premium high-end culinary event that represents the best of the best in each community.
Love to hear that. And so for somebody who's like listening right now, just hearing about Brewery and the Bees for the very first time, can you kind of dig a little bit more deeper as to like what someone could expect if they were to attend?
Definitely. So the name is a little deceiving. Brewery and the Beast was the conceptual name when we came up with it. But we are not a beer fest, and we are not a barbecue or rib fest. This event is definitely a really high-end, chef-driven culinary event that features 100% of the dishes are made with proteins. So it's a very protein-forward event. All of the proteins that are showcased at Brewery and the Beast are 100% Canadian-sourced. And here on the West Coast are primarily sourced from farms in British Columbia and Alberta, and are sourced from farms and ranches that take a very traditional yet progressive approach to farming. So, you know, a real ethical background for a lot of these farms. You know, the animals are you know, growing up in natural environments where they can exhibit natural behaviors, all natural diets, lots of access to space and clean water to drink. And generally just a really, you know, smaller, more boutique style of farming that, you know, raises animals in a environment where the product that is produced is fantastic. And so this is what's featured. We're really looking at that smaller footprint, more regenerative farming practices, and how, you know, taking a different look at farming and food growing. And then those products are featured in the chef's dishes. Almost, I would say, 90% of the food is cooked over live fire. So there's a really, you know, interacting moments there with the chefs and watching them cook and being able to be firsthand and you know, watch these cool fire displays that are set up at the event take place, as well as cooking with wood and charcoal. And, you know, again, very traditional primal ways of cooking. Mm-hmm. And the food that comes out of this with the ingredients and cooking with live fire and the best chefs in the city, the food is outstanding. It's so fresh and it's vibrant and it's unique. And the cool thing about this event is that the ticket is inclusive. So you can eat as much as you want. You can explore as many of the dishes as you want. There's no extra purchases on site. There's no exchanging of tickets or lining up for tickets and then going and get your food. It's just all one enjoyable experience once you're inside. So the food is really outstanding, and there's more than 60 chefs cooking at the event, and they are really the city's best of the best. And we have, you know, chefs coming down from Whistler. We have some chefs coming over from the island. But the majority are those, you know, right in Vancouver and the outlying communities. So, you know, you can expect to see the top restaurants in the community there.
Love it. And you did mention tickets. I'm just curious, what are the ticket prices this year?
So we have two levels of ticket. The main event ticket is $179.95. And again, that is fully inclusive of all of your food, all of your beverages, live music, So once you're inside, you're not purchasing anything. The beverage sizes aren't sample sizes. They're a standard service. So, you know, you're not drinking beer samples or wine samples. You're getting, you know, a proper beverage in hand so you can wander around and enjoy the event at your speed. And the VIP ticket is $299.95, and that gives you an additional 1 hour exclusive culinary event to enjoy food from chefs that have brought in specifically for the VIP event. And then you have a space that you can come and go from during the event as well. So that's an opportunity to have a little more seating, a little more shade, a few extra cool dishes, and it's a great place for hosting friends and family or coworkers.
Love it. And I checked out the website just for like deets and stuff like that. And I noticed that there is a great commitment to community involvement. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. So since inception, we have been benefiting culinary schools with scholarship funding. Mm-hmm. And then we've grown that into more support for food security programs. So whether that's food banks or whether that's, growing programs and teaching people about food and nourishment. So not only is it, emergency services for outreach for people that need food right away, but it's also programming that teaches people how to grow their own food, how to prepare their own food, taking care of lunch programs for kids who are going to school who might not have the resources to provide food on the weekends, as well as food at school. And then we also support a handful of mental health charities associated with the hospitality industry. So outreach for people so they can access mental health care in an industry that otherwise doesn't have a whole lot of, health benefit programs. So, we're hitting on the future of the industry with education. We're hitting on, food security, and then we're helping people out that, just need a hand. And mental health is a really important thing these days, and we want to make sure that people have access to it.
I love it. And you mentioned that you were in Toronto recently. You know, this is the Vancouver. It started off in on the island in Victoria. And I'm just curious, is this the last one of the series, or is there more in 2026?
So in 2026, we had our Toronto event. We'll be in Calgary in a few weeks' time, and then Vancouver, and then we will finish in Victoria at the end of September.
Awesome. All right, guys, Brewing the Beast is happening in Vancouver on August 30th at Concord Pacific Place, 811 Carroll Street. And Scott, how could we get connected with you guys online if we want more information?
Yeah, so for tickets and the full lineup of restaurants, you can go to breweryandthebeast.com and you can select your cities and learn all about us there. And then on Instagram, we are at brewerythebeast, and you can see all the fun stuff that we've been up to this year and years past on our Instagram account. And via our website, you can also sign up for newsletters. So we'll give you advanced notifications for ticket sales dates, next year's event dates, and when ticket sales are getting low. This event does sell out, and we want to make sure people know when things are getting down to the wire, so you have every opportunity to buy, because the amount of emails and text messages and direct messages we get from people saying, "Oh, I didn't buy my tickets. I'm so bummed out now." It happens. It's a thing. If you like what you hear and you go to the website and see the event and be like, "I want to go eat at all those awesome restaurants," scoop your tickets, because they will be gone. And if you miss out, you will be sad.
Yeah. So it's so great that you did say that, because one of my final questions was going to be, do you encourage people to purchase tickets beforehand or wait till the day of? And you pretty much, in a nutshell, said, can sell out. Tickets can sell out.
Yeah, in Toronto 2 weeks ago, there was people showing up the door saying, "I tried to buy tickets and they were sold out." And, unfortunately, we couldn't let them in. So, you don't want to be one of those folks. You want to get your tickets in hand now and come and enjoy the event on event day without any concerns.
Absolutely. And before I let you go, is there anything that we may have missed that you want to share since we're here?
I don't think so. Just, for your listeners, if people are, looking for a great day of food and beverage that's in a fun and relaxed environment and, supports community and supports the local industry, This is a great event to attend because once you're there, you really do get the best of the best, and it's worth the day out, let me tell you.
Absolutely, guys, it's worth the day out. Thank you again so much for joining me today, Scott. Brewing the Beast, again, happening in Vancouver on August 30th at Concord Pacific Place.